Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Speak a bit softer. And welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, and welcome to our second event of 2017, in which I'm going to moderate a panel discussion with my fellow Lowy Institute colleagues on the big issues that will affect Australia and the world in the year ahead. And I think Merida and I were just joking that from now on, I think on our event invitations, we'll add, in addition to sandwiches and high intellect, we also provide air conditioning at the Lowy Institute. So I hope it stands up, and I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to introduce my colleagues in a sec, but let me make a few comments first. Obviously, last year was a very busy year for the Institute and indeed for the world. We hosted journalists such as David Ignatius and Jim Fallows, international policymakers like Jean-David Levite, who was a foreign policy advisor to three French presidents, Jim Clapper, director of national intelligence in the United States, who recently got in a stoush with the newly elected president, Mr. Trump. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull delivered our annual Lowy Lecture, his first major foreign policy address. We hosted speeches by a number of ministers and significant... There'll be Mr. Turnbull there telling me he wants to come back. And a number of other significant figures. In collaboration with Penguin, we published our fourth and fifth Lowy Institute papers, published under the Penguin rubric. The first was The Embarrassed Colonialist by Sean Dorney about the Australia-PNG relationship, and the second was Fighting with America by Professor James Curran of the University of Sydney, which you will have seen has got a lot of play over the last few days. Last week, we did something out of the ordinary. We kicked off our events for the year, not with this event, which is our normal process, but with a specific event on the new Trump administration, just because of the scale of the issues and the level of interest that we were already getting from audiences. Let me just say a couple of things about Mr. Trump to get it out of the way, if you like. The truth is that the United States is rapidly becoming the single biggest source of geopolitical instability in the world. And that's a very sad thing for an Americophile like me to say. And it's sad for many of us, I think, because the stability of leadership from the United States has sort of been a platform for a lot of the other things that have happened, other good things that have happened in the world. But there is enormous uncertainty about the way this administration will govern, the way it will develop, the mistakes it will make, its ability to course correct, and of course the personality and temperament of Mr. Trump himself. We will all get over a testy phone call. It's probably not the first one that Mr. Turnbull has ever had. But it does lead to questions, doesn't it? What are Australians to make of the fact that Mr. Trump had a warm hour-long phone call with Vladimir Putin, an adversary of the United States and a declared opponent of the liberal global order, and yet a 25-minute conversation that may or may not have ended abruptly with a reliable US ally like Australia? It's not really about the call. It's about what that signals about the way the United States is likely to behave over the next few years. I think there's been a lot of premature talk about ending the alliance or downgrading it significantly. The truth is, as an historian, I would say that the alliance has continued for 75 years because it serves the interests of both countries. That's the only reason that alliances survive. And I think that will continue, and I think the alliance is larger than any individual, even Mr. Trump. But I do think that we will need to, as a country, recalibrate our approach to the alliance. We'll need to depersonalize it to some extent, work around Mr. Trump, work through other officials in the executive wing of the government, work even more closely with the legislative wing. And finally, I think we can't always look at everything in the world through an alliance prism. I think this will hopefully be a spur to Australians to try to prosecute a larger foreign policy, to thicken our links to other countries in the region, to other countries in Europe as well, and to see if together we can support this liberal order that is under threat. I think Australia will need to defend international institutions like the United Nations that matter to us, but to which Mr. Trump is ill-disposed. So I do think this is a very important time for Australia really to start to take these issues more seriously than we have in the past. It's a nice segue perhaps into the discussion of introducing the panel. who bring very wide and deep expertise on different areas of the globe. While Mr. Trump is at the top of our minds, we don't want him to dominate our thinking apart from anything else. I find it extremely exhausting keeping track on a minute-by-minute basis to his Twitter feed. So I hope what we can do in this session is not allow Mr. Trump to dominate the discussion. Of course, we're very open to questions on Mr. Trump, and of course I've kicked off by talking about him for a couple of minutes, but I do want us to get beyond Mr. Trump if we can and start to think about other things that are happening in the world. And there's a lot happening this year, the 19th Communist Party Congress, elections in the Netherlands, France, Germany, South Korea, East Timor, PNG in New Zealand, Brexit, and as one of my colleagues pointed out, the centenaries this year of both the Russian Revolution and US entry into the Second World War, and how both of those centenaries are marked, I think, will tell us something, not just about history, but how the current regimes in Moscow and Washington are thinking about history. Let me introduce a terrific panel to discuss some of these topics. On the far end of the panel, John Edwards, a former board member of the Reserve Bank, a former prime ministerial advisor, and a non-resident fellow in international economics at the Institute. Dr. Ewan Graham, director of our international security program and previously a researcher at the Foreign Office, a diplomat at the British Foreign Office, and somebody who understands the region very well. And finally, Dr. Meriden Verral, director of our East Asia program and our in-house expert on China. Let me kick off by asking each panel member to nominate one big issue or development that they think will be very important in 2017. Meriden, let me start with you. What would you nominate?
Sure. Well, thank you, Michael. You referred to it a moment ago. I think the thing to look out for is the 19th Party Congress, which will be happening in October this year in China. People have already been talking a lot about the leadership transition, what's going to happen with President Xi, if he's going to try and stick around. And everyone's looking to this party congress to indicate what his intentions are. There's two key things to be looking at. One is whether Wang Qishan, who is the head of the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, is kept on, although he is technically over the age limit, which is a convention that's been around since 2002. He's 68, so that makes him too old, and whether or not Xi Jinping indicates a successor for himself as well. And so far, he hasn't made any sort of indications in that regard. So there's a flurry of excitement that this may mean that, of course, he's going to try and stay on when his term in various different positions ends around 2022. I think, not that we're having predictions just yet, but I think that Wang Qishan will be kept on despite the age limitations, despite him being 68. It's just a rule, it's not a rule, it's just a convention that Jiang Zemin brought in 2002. It's not all that old, and it's not all that concrete. And I think that his role isn't finished. Anti-corruption campaign isn't finished, and he's still needed as an ally of President Xi's a little bit longer. I don't think we should overestimate what that means in terms of Xi's own position, though, and his own intentions for leadership. So I'll leave it there.
Wonderful. Let me ask you one follow-up. How have you judged the Chinese response to Mr. Trump's various comments and provocations over the last couple of months? Has it surprised you?
I think what's been interesting about the Chinese response is how measured it seems to be. What I've seen in Chinese media is that the Chinese have taken quite a benevolent and magnanimous tone. And in fact, they sound a little bit bemused about this example of what appears to be democracy gone a little bit awry. That it also provides an opportunity for them, perhaps, to play a more prominent role in the region and in global governance affairs as well. So I think that they're anxious about it. That's not to say that they're not concerned about what it means, especially if Trump continues to speak about Taiwan in the way that he's been speaking about Taiwan, about trade, tariffs and trade war in that way. They're certainly anxious, but there's a sense of potential optimism about the opportunity it might present.
What did you think of Xi Jinping's speech to Davos, there was a lot of talk that, is this some sort of passing of the baton? Should we read anything into the fact that you had a Chinese president go to Davos like this and give this kind of speech? Is it significant? Is it just tactical?
I think it's both significant and tactical. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. It's significant because of the symbolism of it, of what he's saying to the domestic population about China being a responsible, meaningful actor on the world stage. But it's also tactical, almost for the same reasons.
And finally, just back on the Party Congress, what does history tell us about Chinese foreign policy behaviour in the year of one of these big meetings? Do they have to play to domestic nationalism and so on, or is it more a case of keeping things calm externally so that they can focus on the sometimes viperish internal party politics? How are the two factors connected, do you think?
Calmness and stability, both internally and externally, are incredibly important. So a leadership transition is a very sensitive time. So it's very important that the domestic issues, I mean, things like the environment, for example, there's been a lot of mass incidents and protests about environmental concerns, pollution. They have to be really carefully managed in the lead up to a transition. But China's international image, going back to the domestic political perceptions, has to also be managed very carefully as well. So it's even more risk-averse than usual.
Okay. Ewan, what do you think will be the big, what's your big, what should we look out for in 2017 in your patch?
I think you've already flagged it. The focus has to be on the United States as a source of instability. But where I think the focus should be is less on the risk of right from the start, purposeful adventurism in this region from the United States. It's more likely to be the unknowables about how uncertainty plays out, uncertainty about where the United States' security priorities and posture lies in Asia. And that, I think, is the most potentially destabilizing variable of all, because in a region that's becoming progressively more multipolar, irrespective of the United States, just the sort of the way that equation is now much less stable than it used to be. It's no longer binary between the United States and another power, certainly not a duopoly in prospect between the United States and China. It's really, as everyone tries to guess whether they're allies or potential adversaries, how that vacuum should be filled. That, I think, is the greatest potential source of instability. But let me make a negative prediction, if you will. If we were to wind the clock back to shortly after the election, when there was a clear expectation that the Trump administration would target traditional allies in Asia, particularly Japan, and look how that's played out since, where Japan has actually, thanks to some rather fleet-footed diplomacy on Prime Minister Abe's part, used that quite effectively, both the relationship build at the personal level, but also the upside, I think, of the US being in a much more uncertain posture, is that gives some room, actually, to the allies to take up some of the slack, to actually find a role on the stage in some of these middle power to middle power relationships that have been nice to have, but not particularly attention grabbing up till now. And if we think of anything from free trade messages, where, you know, Australia and other like-minded countries in the region, like Singapore, can now give, I think, a much more impactful message if they coordinate. As on regional security, if we have Japan and Australia, I just hosted last week an event bringing together South Korean emerging leaders with their Australian counterparts, and that same point was not lost on the Koreans there in the room. Although there's been a template for doing bilateral cooperation in place for some time, it hasn't really got up the decision tree. Now I think there is that political impetus provided by that potential vacuum that the US provides, perhaps in a unknowing way. One other point that I will mention in terms of crises to watch, and it's not new, I did mention it in fact last year, but it's the perpetual crisis of the Korean Peninsula. What's interesting is to see how China, and I'd agree with Meriden's comments, has been cautious in its reaction to the United States, but also North Korea, the one that was expected to be the first crisis out of the blocks, has actually kept its missile and nuclear powder rather surprisingly dry. And I think a lot depends on how those two react to set the tone of security. But if they maintain their current cautious posture, I don't think we're going to see the United States Seventh Fleet sailing in and creating a crisis for the sake of it.
Let me ask you a couple of follow-ups on the Koreas. First, in terms of the North, Mr. Trump did draw something of a red line, although it was a bit fuzzy, when he sent out a tweet a couple of weeks ago saying that, I think he said something like further, you know, these kinds of advances will not be allowed, something like that. What would be, as somebody who served as a British diplomat in Pyongyang, what do you think Kim Jong-un's calculations would be at the moment? There was a lot of speculation that that he would test Donald Trump early, and we think that this was the big crisis that President Obama briefed Donald Trump about in their first meeting at the Oval Office. But as you say, it hasn't eventuated so far. So what would you, first of all, what would be the calculus in Kim Jong-un's mind about how to deal with this new administration? And secondly, where do you think political developments in the South will come out? Obviously, there's a high degree of paralysis at the moment in Seoul. And just, I think it was on Friday, we got the news that Ban Ki-moon, the former UN Secretary General, in fact, someone who spoke to the Institute about 11 years ago when he was running for that role, who was expected to be a candidate and indeed, I think, for a long time was the front runner, has pulled out, showing that politics can be a pretty tough business. So do you think the South Koreans will get their act together politically?
Let's take the North first. I think the calculation is a very standard one for North Korea when a new US administration comes in, which is attempt to play that as a clean slate as far as possible, see what's in the offing as far as a negotiation is workable. Now, the immediate counter to that is, well, the North Korean nuclear and missile train is so far out the station now, can it ever really realistically be brought back in a way that a United States president and a Congress, bearing in mind that any agreement might have to be supported more widely, would be able realistically to get behind. On that, I think we do see, again, it's not a new playbook from North Korea, but it's a continuation of provocation, but below a threshold at which I think they believe Mr. Trump might be forced to lash out. And the tweet that you referred to, he said, it will not happen, exclamation mark, referring to North Korean capability to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile that can carry a nuclear warhead. That, of course, would be a major game changer. I think what we do see in terms of the evidence so far is that satellites have detected missile activity in North Korea, but not of a suspected ICBM, but actually an intermediate range ballistic missile. So it may be that if a test is done, it's below that threshold at which we'll call Mr. Trump's bluff. We've also seen the nuclear reactor at Yongbyon, which was the cause of this crisis going back 25 years ago originally, being restarted, plumes coming out, melting water observed. So that again suggests that there's an attempt to keep the activity train going in a way that keeps the focus on North Korea, and that threat leverage remains the key source of that, but not at a level that will then precipitate a crisis, particularly at this stage where I think North Korea, being the rational-minded people that they are, realize that it may be actually, poking a stick into the proverbial beehive to do it too early on in this administration. As far as the South goes, it is still quite a long way until the next election is due at the end of 2017. It will be in December. If it happens on time, it could come earlier. There are several things that have to fall into place before then. There's the outcome of the Constitutional Court decision about whether to proceed with the impeachment of President Park Geun-hye, the current incumbent. Our Korean participants last week were firmly of the mind that that would be the case, but it's still not clear then whether it would be a left-leaning or, as is currently the case, someone from the right of centre in Mrs. Park's own party. If you want to draw me to a percentage, it seems likely that left-wing party will triumph. And if that is the case, then I think that is the potential alliance trouble spot to watch. Not Australia on the back end of a scrappy phone call, not Japan on the back end of the editorials that Donald Trump posted in the 1980s, but it will then be, I think, the more structural problem of a left-wing president who has already publicly questioned the deployment of US missile defense systems to his country, and in which the United States may then very well find itself in a rather troubling scrap over burden sharing and alliance roles and missions and how to handle not just the North Korean issue, but of course as a subset of that, China relations will very quickly become involved. And that again gets to the uncertainty. You have uncertainty in Washington, deep uncertainty in Seoul, and that I think is really the stuff of crises rather than a kind of home-cooked adventurism.
Let me ask you one more question before I bring John Edwards in. We've spent a lot of time in the last 2 weeks worrying about what Mr. Trump is doing wrong and how he's mucking up bilateral relations with Canberra or Mexico City or whenever. But let me ask you a sort of a more typical question that you would get at this stage of a presidential administration. That is, what would you advise Donald Trump to do on the North Korean issue in order to limit, let me just ask you that. What should he do? We spend a lot of time reacting to the wrong things he's doing, but what if you had a couple of minutes with Mr. Trump, how would you advise him to deal with Pyongyang?
He's already done one thing right. That was to send out Secretary Mattis, and it's a broader point than just North Korea, but the Defense Secretary has conducted his first trip to the region. He went to Tokyo, he went to Seoul, and very clearly his brief was to provide reassurance that the United States was not pulling back, that it was not lunging forward either, and it was a very traditional sort of message that those alliances are still bread and butter of the United States' Asian security posture. That is essential for how you deal with North Korea because the consistency of that message is important so that you don't end up running the risk of sending out false signals to the North Korean regime, in which a tweet would be one obvious case in point, whether it then corrals Kim Jong-un into feeling that there is no deal in offer or that a premature sense that a deal might be there. I mean, there was a rather joking reference to inviting him in for a hamburger at one point. That, again, would not be my advice. The advice would be to keep the channel open, to make sure that negotiations are there, but that there is a firm and consistent message of the importance of the South Korean alliance, but also America's willingness to use coercion and to threat the real, to have forceful diplomacy to be credible, has to have the credible threat force behind it. And that, I think, is something that we've had bipartisanship in recent administrations. President Obama, whose policy on North Korea, I think, did deserve criticism in that it didn't stop the nuclearization continuing. But nonetheless, I think the consistency of US military exercises was there. The other part, the wild card, if you like, about where Mr. Trump will go on North Korea is also there in the tea leaves of his campaign, because he also referred to getting China to sort out the problem for the United States. On that, I would advise caution, because that's not a new position. Every US administration who has assumed that China will somehow have a get-out-of-jail-free approach on North Korea and suddenly get tough when after decades of a rather awkward relationship between Pyongyang and Beijing, which is referred to as a relationship based on as close as lips and teeth. The lips are pared back and the teeth have been gnashing at one another for a long time. There's no love lost in that relationship. But I think the geopolitics overrides that, and Xi Jinping is not going to cut North Korea loose in a way that would please Donald Trump instantly.
Dr. John Edwards, let me bring you into the conversation. One thing I've noticed in the past couple of months is a disconnect between foreign policy analysts who have been tearing their hair out about some of the odd things that Mr. Trump has said, and the markets who have seemed actually quite pleased with many, to the extent that I can read them as a non-economist. You had the boomlet immediately after Trump's election, and the last time I looked, the share market in the United States was still doing very well. How would you explain the way that, how would you explain the way markets have reacted to Mr. Trump's election? And secondly, looking forward to 2017, what do you think how do you think he will affect the international economy and our part of the world in particular?
Well, let me take the first part of that, the second part of that first, and say that I do think it's going to be absolutely engrossing this year to observe the impact of the Trump administration on the global economy. And I say that not because I think it's going to be a big impact, but I think it probably won't be. It probably won't be. That when you look at the things that Trump promises, it's very difficult to see him delivering any of them in a plausible sort of way. For example, US growth now running at 2%. He wants to get it up to 4%. But unemployment's already at 4.7. It can't go very much lower. It can go a little bit lower, but not very much lower. Productivity is running now at 0.5, and the long-term rate of growth of the workforce is about 0.5. So he's got to get productivity up even to sustain growth at last year's level, which last year's rate, which was 2%. To get to 2.5, he may well get to 2.5. 4, I think, is pretty well out of reach. So I think he'll probably get to the end of this year with no very marked uptick in US rate of growth. That's one thing. On the trade side, I don't know whether the Trump's administration to disavow the Trans-Pacific Partnership really is as widely noticed in the rest of the world as it is here. This was an agreement that, you know, was the gold standard of trade agreements from an American point of view, entirely from an American point of view, in terms of investor-state protections, in terms of services trade, in terms of intellectual protections. It was basically designed by Americans for the profile of American industry. If the US doesn't want to pursue it, I think, you know, we have plenty of options, and so do the other 11 members who wanted it to remain. From our point of view, our trade with all 11 other members of the, our exports to all 11 members of the proposed TPP is much less than our, in total, much less than our exports now to China and Hong Kong. For us, it was always, I think, a bit of a sideline. Well, where can he go on trade? It seems to me there are various things you can do. I certainly think the US should be vigorously pursuing an investor agreement with China. China is investing very heavily offshore, but is putting all kinds of restrictions on developed country investment in China. And that has to change. But this negotiation has already begun in the Obama administration. It should continue, perhaps more vigorously. But when it comes to the idea of a 40% tariff on Chinese imports to the US, the cost of those will be paid by the people who shop at Home Depot and Walmart, by Trump's constituency. It doesn't make sense. And things that don't make sense at all usually don't survive for very long as actual policy proposals that people want to put into effect. you've got to have some intention, some gain, some expectation you're going to get something out of it. So I think we'll end up with a prolonged sort of trade negotiation between the US and China. It's one that Australia and other nations will quietly cheer on, because whatever the US gets by way of concessions will sooner or later get. But still, I think we'll get to the end of the year and nothing much really in the global economy has changed. I think that's... Now, I think this is very interesting because it offers two possibilities. One is that Mr. Trump's rhetoric will get louder and louder as he discovers the gap between, you know, his campaign rhetoric and what he can actually do. And the other possibility is the administration will, as every other administration has, will just learn to live with reality slowly. And indeed, you can see that's already happening, been happening in the last week. But I think the more probable result, Michael, is that both things will happen. That is, I think it's highly likely the administration will, in a practical way, learn to live with the rest of the world. It'll learn, if it doesn't already know it, the limitations of America's ability to change, rapidly change the global economy or its own trading relationships. But I don't think that will really suit Mr. Trump. I think we may well find his rhetoric becoming more unrestrained as the US actually settles down to, you know, its long-term relationships.
What about the first question I asked you? Have you been surprised by the reaction of markets since the election of Mr. Trump? Are they responding really to his references to corporate tax cuts, infrastructure spending, defence spending? Is that what is driving their exuberance or their optimism?
Well, I think it is, and I think it is the... It's a recollection of the Reagan administration also, which was the start of a huge equity boom that, you know, went on for decades. People are remembering that. But I think these are mistaken suppositions on the part of markets. Not wildly mistaken, but I think they're going to be disappointed. They'll be disappointed because when Reagan came to office, there was a very small deficit, declining deficits. Interest rates were very high and about to come down very dramatically. Unemployment was very, very high in 1991. And there were a lot of vital resources in the US. It was a perfect economy for a very long period of falling interest rates and rising budget deficits, which is exactly what the Reagan administration produced. And today's circumstances don't resemble those at all. Interest rates will be rising, US dollar rising, and the US deficit already 2% of GDP and on just on present programs will double in over the course of the first term of the Trump administration. So I don't think they resemble the expectations that the market has. And I think also he's very limited in what he can do on tax or in the expectation that, for example, a personal income tax cut, basically favouring the rich, which is what he proposes, won't necessarily have any impact on investment. And if it doesn't have any impact on investment, it won't have an impact on productivity and it won't have an impact on profitability. He now seems to have moved to the corporate income tax cut model that is being proposed by the House Republicans, who are concerned about deficits, and their corporate income tax cut is revenue neutral. That is, it too can't have an overall impact on investment, or not very much, and therefore not on profitability. So I think that the market is probably mistaken in some of its assumptions, and it'll pull back, presumably, at some point later in the year.
Let me ask John one more question and then I'm going to come to the audience and give you an opportunity to ask questions to the panel. The decline, John, the decline in manufacturing in the United States and indeed Australia and other developed countries has been something that that politicians in general, parties of the left in particular, have so often made noises about remedying. And indeed, even over the, I think today there was an opinion poll out that said that something like, I think, 7 or 8 Australians would like to see more manufacturing in Australia. Mr. Trump is trying something He's trying to use the bully pulpit to really hector multinationals into investing more and making more things in America. And there's almost no limit to what he will do. He has the ability to affect the share price of companies. He's shown that he will punish those who deviate and he'll reward those who fall in line. Now, can I ask you, does this have any prospect of making a difference to the long-term trend? Obviously, one factory here or there is not going to make any consequential difference. But is there any possibility that other multinationals will internalize some of those issues and therefore decide that for bigger reasons affecting the company, that even if they haven't been targeted by Mr. Trump, they're going to invest more and try to make more things in the United States? Does he have any ability of succeeding with this strategy, I guess is my question? Or do the laws of mathematics inevitably mean that those companies will continue to move those plants to lower cost environments?
Well, it's not the first time the US has tried this. It did the same with Japan, Taiwan, and Korea in the 80s, and it wasn't entirely without success. There were voluntary restraints agreed on auto exports to the US. There was voluntary restraints on steel exports to the US, and Korea and Japan did set up some auto manufacturing in the US, which they mightn't otherwise have done, and it's still there. But it's also notable, isn't it, that despite all that, actually the decline in manufacturing employment in the US continued. That it itself didn't really make more than a marginal difference. And I don't think these kind of pressures will in the long run make more than a marginal difference. That'll be helpful for Mr. Trump rhetorically, but I don't think it'll be sufficient to, certainly not sufficient to see manufacturing employment in the US setting up.
All right, who would like to ask some questions? I'll go to this lady first, and then I saw Hannah, and I saw these two.
Carla Pencott from the Centre for Independent Studies. My question's for John. John, Trump has come out very strongly for a weak dollar, and Janet Yellen is in favour of a strong dollar. She'll be gone in about a year or so, but how do you see that situation playing out between now and then?
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? I'm not throughout the campaign, Trump and his advisers were very critical of the Federal Reserve, but not for tightening rates. They were critical of the Federal Reserve for quantitative easing and for rates that were extremely low, that they were critical of the expansionary policies, essentially, of the Federal Reserve, and that is because, for one reason or another, it didn't really square with whatever notions they had of how economies operate. There doesn't seem to be among the... Trump will be replacing Yellen with somebody, you know, more ideologically sympathetic, presumably, next year. But there doesn't seem to be any intention within the administration to keep interest rates low. And in fact, they seem to be, if anything, cheering the Fed on. And of course, if interest rates continue to go up, as I think they almost certainly will, so will the US dollar. If Trump succeeded in reducing US imports into the US, the dollar might well be even stronger. So I don't think, it doesn't seem to me likely that anything within Trump's control will be able to produce a weaker dollar.
Hannah Wirth was the next person.
I'm Hannah from the Institute. I had another question for John about the economy. Given that the Trump administration is threatening to unwind a lot of the financial regulation that was put in place after the global financial crisis, do you think that's going to introduce new risks? And also, what does that say about US economic leadership?
Well, that Hannah, that's the thing that I guess worries me most about the Trump administration, is because it's entirely within the control of the administration, or of the administration and the regulators that it appoints, and with the and within the control of Congress, which we know would like to see a lot of the regulatory constraints in Dodd-Frank and in the imposition of the Volcker Rule removed. And in the longer term, I think this guarantees that we will have another global financial crisis, depending on what they withdraw. But certainly if investment banks, and investment banks these days are often also have their deposits guaranteed, in the case of Goldman, for example, it's actually become a commercial bank, you know, as well as an investment bank. And if it's able to run huge proprietary positions as it used to be able to, take huge bets, I can't see that it's going to end in anything good. And if, as is supposed, the commercial banks, which have had to build up capital buffers, can now return those to their shareholders, which is the reason that US bank stocks have gone up in the last few days, then that too will have unpleasant consequences. The only thing I'd say is probably won't be this year.
It also illuminates the tensions, I guess, between the people who voted for Mr. Trump, who are probably in many cases who are still angry, I think, about the global financial crisis, and the people around Mr. Trump and staffing Mr. Trump's government, who are not. So I think it's one of the tensions to watch. Sir.
Hi, Tim Johnson. If I could ask two questions. One of you, Marin. The sort of chaos in US foreign policy at the moment, do you think that's going to be interpreted in Beijing as weakness, i.e. a green light to be more forward, or is it going to be unpredictability, a sort of Nixon-esque madman policy? And one for you, John. The uncertainty that Marilyn talked about with the 19th Party Congress in China, the uncertainty over the trade environment, the uncertainty over the monetary environment, do you think that increases the risks of some sort of economic problems, catastrophe, hard landing in China?
Thanks. So if I'll go first. I think it's a combination probably of both weakness and unpredictability. So because China hasn't been used to seeing a US that seems weak, that raises uncertainties about what that means for how China, for how the US will behave. Now, weakness of the US, I think China, as I said before, views it as a sort of positive opportunity, perhaps. But I think China isn't absolutely cognizant of exactly what it means to have a world without the US as strong. I think the idea that perhaps it leaves a little bit more space for China, particularly in the region, is being met positively. But what that actually means in practice, I think China hasn't really grappled with practically, beyond a sort of vague sense that it might be rather nice, that the sort of sacrifices and resources that the US has used in the region, if they're not there, if China would like to take on that role, it requires an awful lot of investment from them, and I don't think they really understand what that means in practice. Certainly they don't like unpredictability. I think that's a fairly simple and then well understood thing to say about China. So there will be a lot of anxiety about what that means at the same time.
Ewan.
Just to counter to that, I'm not sure that China will necessarily see it all as US weakness. I think China will also be mindful of the fact that however unpredictably it might come, this is a US administration that's also very careful, you know, deliberately signaling that it's going to take its national interests into account first. It's going to be more willing to take on strategic risk with China. That's what the Taiwan phone call was basically saying. And the subsequent comments about one China. And that, you know, although I don't think it's going to go to the level of a naval blockade to prevent access to the artificial islands in the South China Sea, I think that that was probably Mr. Tillerson getting out a little bit too far in front of his brief before he'd mastered it. But nonetheless, I think we have seen enough to back up that this is a US administration that's saying it's prepared to stand up for its interests and it will use its assets to do so. I think that will be treated very cautiously in China. That's why I think it partly explains the fact that we are in this sort of somewhat recessed mode of shadow playing between Beijing and Washington at the moment.
Is it very bad form to respond to a response?
No, just if you can.
Very quickly.
Yeah, go.
Just, I think that's not necessarily a perception of strength. It's a perception of perhaps belligerence, but not necessarily, from the Chinese point of view, a sense that that America's got a nice, neat strategy which it will now be deploying in a nice, coherent way. So I wouldn't necessarily see that as an understanding of strength in a positive way.
Do you want to respond to the response? You'll leave it for the moment. All right, John, the second question, I think, was it really about the prospects of financial crisis in China?
Yes, that's right. And an interesting twist on that question would, you know, does the new administration greater uncertainty influence the probability of that or its scope or whatever? And I would say that the risk of a financial crisis in China is significant, and the consequences would be calamitous, far more calamitous than anything we expect in the economic realm from the Trump administration, far more calamitous, and particularly for us. So I suppose I regard it as one of those events that has a very high impact but low probability, and low probability, of course, because although there is a large, you know, amount of unserviceable loans in China, they're all in yuan, they're all basically not all, but a very large part of it is Chinese state-owned banks lending to Chinese state-owned industries. And if you take the whole, if China manages it appropriately, it would likely take its government debt, you know, when it has to, in the end, resolve it, which it sooner or later will, it would take its government debt from around about 40% of GDP now, probably to 60, possibly 70% of GDP, which is still well below that of the US and a fraction of what it is in Japan. So it's quite capable, China's quite capable of dealing with it if necessary, but the risk is always that the event will occur in a way that they find difficult to manage. As to whether I can't really see the political uncertainty or the economic uncertainties about Trump really affecting it one way or the other, since it's so much a domestic issue. The only way in which it might affect it is that an important part of the Trump attitude to China is that it should have a markedly higher yuan, renminbi, that it should appreciate. And of course, China's argument, which I think is true, is that it's struggling actually to keep it where it is, against the outflow of against private sector outflows. But if the private sector in China became convinced that renminbi in fact would be appreciated, then that would have the effect of slowing the outflow from China. So from China's point of view, it might be a positive.
Now, we've only got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to take two or three questions, and then I'll give each panellist an opportunity to address any bits of the question they'd like and also to make any quick closing comment. So I saw Rob down here. I saw this gentleman at the front, and there was a hand over here, I think, this gentleman here. So those are the final three questions, I'm afraid. If I can ask the questioners to keep it brief.
Just a quick question. You touched on briefly, we've obviously got elections happening in Europe coming up, and obviously we've seen that with the Trump shift to the right, and I think we'll probably see a shift to the right in Europe as well. I'd like to understand how you see the ramifications on that, both at geopolitical impacts as well as humanitarian, because as both all of these parties seem to be stopping immigration and focusing on isolationism. So I'd like to understand the impacts of that, please.
Yeah, we've only really mentioned Russia in terms of the one-hour phone call. So I'm just wondering whether Vladimir Putin feels bemused, emboldened, and what you think his stance and Russia's stance will be, particularly given NATO and also nations like Finland's concern over what an emboldened Russia may mean.
Thank you. And the final question down here, Andrew, or Sophia, thank you.
Thank you, John Davies. Whilst many can and do go on ad nauseam about Donald Trump's shortcomings, is there anything at all positive about Donald Trump moving into the White House?
Great question. Three terrific questions. So John, I might start with you. We've got, and you're welcome, everybody's welcome to have a go at whichever questions they like. And I'll try to clean up if there's anything left on the table after that. But we had a question about European elections, what that means about European foreign policy, but also European policy on election. How will Mr. Putin be feeling about developments over the last couple of months? And what is the positive that we can take out of Mr. Trump's election? John.
Well, it's such an interesting question, isn't it? What's positive about Trump? And I suppose it would be that we've been ignoring these things for too long. You know, he's taken them up. He's presented them. We don't like imports. We don't like cheap labour, migration. I don't think he's taken them up in a way that suggests that he can deal with it. And there's a lot of other stuff mixed up with it that I think serves other purposes. But I think that's good that we're dealing with that. And I guess I'd say the same in Europe, that we can't hide from these things indefinitely. But that's the only positive outcome I can see. And it gives us an opportunity to expose them to the light of day and perhaps I would regard the both in Europe and the US, the most beneficent result of all this might be that we're a little bit better educated on what we can actually do by way of mending these shortcomings.
Ewan.
There are a few questions. The Europe one, I don't really have a sharper take on it other than to say I confirm exactly your feelings that this will be a more isolationist and introspective Europe. I mean, the big wild card would be whether we get a Le Pen presidency. If we do, then goodbye to the euro, potentially goodbye to the EU. That would be, a calamitous outcome. At the moment, I think Angela Merkel is really the one individual who's keeping the whole vehicle on the autobahn. We also have an uncertainty about what that would mean if her position is significantly weakened or she feels that her very strong and apparently personal attachment to migration is no longer politically tenable. I just think it's a bad outlook for Europe. My own country, the UK, it looks as if a hard Brexit is on the cards. I think the economic downside of that will eat into a lot of the ambition for dealing globally. The headwinds for seeking beneficial trade deals, to put it mildly, are severe. Now, maybe the United States will be the one positive in that relationship. That's why I think, for sheer national interest reasons, Theresa May was right to go to Washington when she did. Caveat emptor applies. I think when dealing with negotiations with this administration, it may not be as an open door as it looks from the outside. In terms of Russia, I think one very significant statement from the president was that he would potentially visit Moscow first. So why do anything if it's going to come to you? I think Mr. Putin has no need to dash out and try to dictate his agenda. That would confirm all of the fears in the US that there was an interference for geopolitical gain. So I think he's smarter than that. I think he will probably play it more coolly. Indicator, however, in Ukraine is already there that he feels, I think, he has a freer hand with the signs that recent offensive has been resumed. In terms of positives about Mr. Trump, let me play devil's advocate. I think that there are some. If there is an adjustment that's required in the US security posture in Asia, maybe it will be somewhat precarious in how we get there. But the Trump administration is probably radical enough to make a leap, and it may be a leap to something that's less committed to preserving the status quo than a Clinton presidency would have been, or to pursuing a liberal interventionist foreign policy, which ultimately may have been more destabilizing for the China relationship. So if we look at the China relationship now and assume that It's all calamity, it's all confrontation. That might be the bluster through which we evolve to a new relationship between the US and China. It may be difficult and bumpy in how we get there, but that would be one positive counter to that. And finally, let's bring it home to ourselves. I mean, I think if there's a positive from this, it also it throws the initiative on middle powers in a way that has not been the case recently. Australia has a great deal, I think, to be thinking about, and what better timing to have a foreign policy white paper being drafted now, when there is a blank sheet of paper in a way I think that has not been the case for a generation because of all the uncertainties around our closest ally. And I think that gives, it unlocks the potential for Australia and other middle powers in Asia to be able to do more with each other, to take up some of that vacuum in leadership, which the US is very consciously stepping away from. So it's not all bad.
All right, I'll start from the bottom up. Positive about Donald Trump. Building on what John said, I think it also provides a timely opportunity for Australia to consider how we deal with these challenges in our policy and in our population as well. I was reading in the papers today and yesterday that Pauline Hanson's popularity is increasing and that the Liberal Party is really seeing a challenge from her and her position. And a lot of people said that Donald Trump could never make it, that it would never happen. And people say the same sort of things about Pauline Hanson. But I think we really need to take that seriously, that those parts of our population who are disgruntled need to be taken seriously in the same way. So it's an opportunity for us to build stronger policy to address those. In terms of Russia, I don't know how Putin feels, but there's an interesting dynamic there about if the Russia-America relationship gets stronger, what that means for the Russia-China relationship, because that's always been a kind of counterpoint to some extent, and that has implications then for how China and Russia use each other in the world stage if Russia and China get Russia and America get closer. The last thing about Europe and shifting to the right, the implications there. I think there's implications for global governance. For a Europe that starts to look more inwards, that starts to be less engaged with the global system, with its role on the global stage, and if we've got a situation where Donald Trump is, to some extent, removing himself from the global governance role, and the EU is also doing so, again, that leaves an interesting space for other actors to take more of that space.
There's nothing to clean up, so I won't try. I would associate myself, though, with Ewan's comment that that one positive out of Mr. Trump's election is that it puts the wood on the rest of us to step up and try to defend this global order. And that means countries like Australia need to do more. We need to have a more sophisticated debate. If that means less press coverage of private school fees and house prices, then sacrifices must be made. It also, I guess, has certainly made me at some level personally grateful to be living in Australia, to be living in a country where, despite the rise of figures on the extremes, we still have institutions like compulsory voting that make that less likely. And it's also made me more grateful of the parliamentary system, something that I criticise quite a lot in my Boyer lectures. I criticise the churn in the parliamentary leadership ranks. But we know that in our kind of system, if you had a leader who was really placing himself or herself out of the mainstream and behaving in a way that made all the colleagues feel very uncomfortable, the truth is they would not survive, whereas in the United States, such a leader is protected by the Constitution. So perhaps it'll make us do more and feel a bit happier about how we're doing as a country. Thank you very much, everybody, for some really terrific questions today. Let me mention that tomorrow, Ewan will be chairing a lecture by a distinguished Japanese visitor, Professor Akiko Fukushima, on the future of the Australia-Japan Security Partnership, which is one of the potential things that might increase as a result of Mr. Trump's election. Let me thank the panel, who I think did a fantastic job today. I learned a lot, and let me thank you all again, and we look forward to seeing you soon at Bligh Street. Thank you.